I think it's great that more stories are getting told. You know, I think that specificity actually, I think and I hope, leads to greater possibilities for connection and solidarity, because I think we really connect to stories through that specificity, right? If you try to make like one Asian American movie that speaks to everyone, I don't think it's going to connect to anyone. But I think, you know, for example, like lots of people that are not Asian Americans really connected to Claudia. I had people saying, oh my God, like, you know, my grandmother also lived with the family, or, you know, I also had this really overbearing older sister or whatever. I think it's through the specificity that we're able to connect to the stories.
Well, hello and welcome to How Do You Like It So Far? This is Colin McClay.
And I'm Henry Jenkins.
And I didn't tell you what this podcast is about, which is a podcast about popular culture and our changing world. And today we are thrilled to have Sue Ding join us. She's a documentary filmmaker and mixed media specialist, creator, curator, and much, much more. And has a new mini doc out this summer on Netflix called The Claudia Kishi Club. And welcome, Sue.
Hi, guys. Great to be here.
Great to be with you in these apocalyptic times as we have like a little mini break from the chaos of the world and dive into you and your work. And I guess I wanted to start with just a little bit of how you got into kind of storytelling in the first place and what drew you to documentary work and your interest in mixed reality.
I don't know. As a kid, I was always, you know, I really experienced the world through stories. You know, I would just go hang out at the library for a day, really just like read through whole chunks of the children's section. You know, especially I think as a second generation immigrant who's growing up in a really white space. I think I always had like a vaguely anthropological perspective on the world around me. You know, trying to like figure out everything that was going on and, you know, through pop culture and all of that. So I think from the beginning, I always had an interest in how we shape our identity through narrative. And then of course, later on, you know, who has the power to create narratives, how people are creating new narratives or new ways of storytelling.
I guess I'm curious just to tell a little bit about your own, like your upbringing and what it was like. I mean, so there's all kinds of stories that we have or images we have of what it's like to live in, you know, in second generation households and the pressures of immigrant parents and, you know, sort of the stereotypes that we see in the media of what it's like to be, you know, this or that or the other kind of person. Like, and so what were you like and what kinds of pressures did you feel or were there expectations placed on you and what kind of models did you have?
I mean, I definitely had the stereotypical strict Asian parents who wanted me to pursue math or science. You know, I think for them, they really saw that as a path to stability. And, you know, I always wanted to be an artist. So there was always that kind of, I feel like, you know, the rebellious teen, like, no, I want to go to art camp, you know, like all of those things. Yeah, I think it was always, I think growing up between cultures was always just something that made me interested in the world around me and interested in kind of different perspectives, right? Because you're seeing around you just people approaching the world in different ways.
And how did that, like, how did you get to documentary work from that? Like, how did it work? You know, like, how do you're like, okay, wait a second, I'm doing this in my head and I can do this for real? Or like, what was that transition like?
Right, totally. And I feel like, well, I feel like that's, you know, being between multiple worlds is a big part of, I've always just wanted to do everything, right? To exist in multiple worlds. And I think that's also shaped my career path because I started out wanting to be an artist. I wanted to be a fashion designer. You know, I wanted to do all these creative things. And then when I went to college, I majored in studio art and then also international relations. And kind of landed on documentary eventually after college as a way to kind of like be able to do the most things possible, right? I was like, this is like the secret. I found it. This is a career path that allows me to actually just keep on doing lots of different things, right? This is a continued lack of commitment. And so I think You know, and then I started doing public television stuff. And then I was like, well, this is, I still need even more things. And then that's how I got to mixed media. Because I was like, all the things.
Well, so as you're telling the story, I mean, as someone who has recently watched the new Babysitter's Club series, I can now I have like a much better sense of why you wanted to make this documentary. But like, can you tell us about the doc and how that came about and like how you realized, you know, like where the Babysitter's Club, what role Claudia Kishi was for you and how you came to want to make a documentary about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely a personal passion project for me. You know, Claudia was a really important character to me as a kid, where I was reading voraciously, but I very rarely encountered any characters of color. And then the few that I did encounter were usually, you know, token sidekicks or often like just offensive. And then, you know, there were a few more thoughtful representations of people of color, you know, that centered their experiences, but those protagonists often seemed defined by their oppression. You know, they were victims, or they were really just suffering a lot. And of course, later, I really appreciated the importance of those stories of struggle, of resistance, of history. But at the time, you know, that really didn't feel empowering to me. It didn't make me feel seen, you know, it didn't feel very close to my experience. And they didn't feel relatable in the sense of like, oh, I could be friends with these kids, or, you know, this is like my life. And so when I encountered the Babysitter's Club and Claudia, you know, she was really the first Asian American character that I had ever encountered that did feel relatable and aspirational, you know, because she really felt like she was a fully fleshed out character beyond just being like, oh, the Asian one. And of course, you know, as someone who had creative aspirations, she really spoke to me, and she didn't fulfill a lot of the stereotypes that we saw of Asian characters at the time.
Yeah. So say a little bit about her, like the, you know, who she is and also a little bit about the Babysitter's Club, which like for me, that was a little bit after my generation. So I wasn't aware until my daughter started reading, you know, and like has read all the books and now binge the show. So give us a little bit of context on both.
Totally. Yeah. Well, so the Babysitter's Club was a phenomenon. You know, the first book came out in 1986. They continued until, I believe, 2000. There were hundreds of books. There were, you know, multiple spin-off series. There was a TV show. There was a movie. You know, there was so much merchandise. and, you know, I think for a time, it was actually the best-selling series, book series in America, not just for children, but, you know, overall. So it felt like it was everywhere. And it was just about these girls in suburban Connecticut who had a club and they babysat kids. But it was really about, you know, their friendships, their families, their, you know, their growth as people together. And it was just, it had this crazy mass appeal and a big influence on, I think, a lot of people who grew up at that time. And then Claudia is one of the main characters. She's the vice president of the club. She's the creative one. You know, she's an aspiring artist. She's known for her iconic style. You know, she's always wearing these crazy outfits. And she is not good at school. She really struggles with kind of subjects outside art. And she is a little insecure about that because her older sister is a genius and has a genius IQ and is, you know, probably like building a supercomputer before that was even a thing. but yeah. And so she felt like, she had all these different facets to her personality, and certainly she's Japanese American and that was part of her story, but it wasn't the only thing about her story. Mm-hmm. And she was one of the more, I think a lot of people looked, or a lot of readers looked up to Claudia, and not just Asian American readers, but all readers, because she was really, I think the thing that was appealing about her was her confidence. You know, she would go to school wearing these crazy outfits. It would be like a man's tuxedo jacket and like three different pairs of socks layered in different colors and like, you know, earrings that she had made herself out of, you know, like lobsters or something. And, you know, I think, and she just, if you didn't get it, it was like, whatever, she was just doing her thing. And I think for kids at, you know, who are at the age of Babysitter's Club readers, a lot of kids are just trying to kind of fit in, right? Like not get made fun of, not do anything that's like not cool. And so to see this character just like letting her freak flag fly and just like not caring what other people think and really just being like, well, this is what I feel and this is what I'm going to do was kind of like, whoa, you know? And so I think a lot of people really aspire or found her aspirational.
Yeah. So that sounds pretty awesome, right? Because the comparison is like, there's nothing else out there, right? As you said, the characters are bit characters. They're one dimensional. They're not, you know, they're tropes or whatever. And then here, there's someone who's not just struggling, but like inspiring. And so how did you get from having a personal connection to Babysitter's Club and Claudia Kishi to a documentary? And like, did you realize, you know, were you aware that other people were clued into this or how did that happen?
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, I had been a big fan of Claudia as a kid and then, you know, moved on with my life to some extent.
Modestly.
To some extent. Yeah, exactly. and then kind of as an adult, as like a, you know, as I was starting my filmmaking career, I had thought about doing a project about Claudia and sort of at the same time in the early, like, 2010s, I want to say it was the sort of the golden age of the blogosphere. Social media was exploding, and I started to notice a lot of stuff about the Babysitter's Club. You know, whether it was like which character are you quizzes on BuzzFeed, or you know, like Live Journal fan pages or anything like that. It started to pop up a lot, and I think it was just like millennials really coming of age, having a platform to talk about these things and paying homage to the media that shaped our childhoods. And specifically, I noticed a lot of stuff around Claudia. I mean, just as one of the most popular characters, but then also Asian American women talking about Claudia as the first time that they had ever seen an Asian American character or they had ever connected to an Asian American character. And that's kind of when I realized that there was this larger community, because this has been a very individual experience for me relating to Claudia growing up, because there weren't that many Asian Americans around to kind of like fangirl out about Claudia. But I realized that lots of other people had been having this experience, and specifically a lot of people who ended up pursuing creative paths, you know, like authors that I was following on social media, artists talking about, you know, not only Claudia as an Asian American icon, but as someone who specifically had been a creative role model for them, because there weren't that many Asian American artists or writers kind of in the mainstream when we were growing up either. And so that was really the seed for the documentary, where, you know, I kind of realized it wasn't just about telling Claudia's story, but it was about telling the story of how she had affected people's lives and kind of contributed to this new generation of Claudias who are now telling their own stories and making really, really badass and awesome work.
I wanted to ask you about the collage aesthetic that you use in the documentary, which seems to pay tribute to a lot of that grassroots creativity.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think for me, it was kind of one of the big puzzle pieces that I had to figure out, because I knew that I wanted the documentary to really reflect Claudia's creativity and the creativity of the people in it. And of course, you know, this like nostalgic imagery of the book covers and kind of the merchandise that everyone has this visceral connection to, or that the fans have this visceral connection to. But I didn't exactly know how to do it. I started interviewing people. I started putting together the script, and that was always like, and then we'll figure out that piece. And I'd always thought about maybe, you know, bringing on a motion graphics person or working with an animator. But motion graphics and animation are very expensive. and I wanted a lot of visual stuff happening. You know, I didn't want there just to be like a title sequence and then for it to just be interviews. Like, I wanted it to be a real piece of the film. And so actually a friend just suggested, why don't you just start making paper collages yourself? And so I started, you know, I went to Michael's, I bought a bunch of construction paper, I printed out pictures of Babysitter's Club stuff, and kind of just as a, you know, in my head, I thought, okay, these will be like storyboards for eventually someone else is going to take these and like do something cool with them. And, you know, I started putting them into the script and seeing how they worked with the film, you know, like, okay, well, like here we can show that Claudia is doing this, or like, this will be a great place to have a little section about this. And I kept, you know, I'd put them into the film as I was editing, and I kept like editing them and making new ones. So many trips to Michael's. And then it just ended up that I ended up doing all the stop motion animation, which was crazy. It was so much work. I shot all of it on my living room floor. You know, my carpet still has glitter in it and probably will forever.
forever.
I can never go back now. And so it was very hard. Stop motion animation is a lot of work. But it was really cool because I think on the one hand, it was a new creative experience for me. It's a very different method of filmmaking than I'm used to. And usually once you're in the editing or once you're in post-production, you're just editing on a computer and that's kind of like the process. But for me, I was editing on a computer, but I was also cutting out tiny pieces of paper and like gluing rhinestones to things. And I think it was really a nice way for it, you know, it felt very Claudia. It felt very DIY and it felt like a way to like, for me to embody the spirit of Claudia in the way that the film was getting made. So, yeah.
That's awesome. And I think it looks great. I love the film and I love
Thank you.
I love that. Those elements of it just like give it real, like a totally different feel, right? Than it would have if you just strung together a bunch of amazing interviews with great, you know, with great settings, like with all their, you know, kind of kitchen, you know, whatever. But so I can't help but think of, it makes me think of like the Velvet Underground, which, you know, famous for like, you know, wasn't very popular in its day, but everyone who did listen started a band, except for this was very popular. And then the folks who, you know, who followed it and like went out and were inspired by it. And the people that you interview, both men and women, which is, I think, another interesting aspect of this, who went on to create in all kinds of interesting ways, whether graphic novels or indeed the Netflix series or, you know, whatever else, in ways that it seems to me that they also kind of explicitly took on issues around representation. And did they see themselves and people like them in the way you described, in empowering ways in the media that they were making, which really moving the ball forward in a way of like not just stopping there, but building it out further, which to me seemed really exciting.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think like that was really important to me because, you know, it is, the documentary does take on the subject of representation, and I wanted to approach it in a way that first of all was very personal and very specific, because representation is really hard to talk about. You know, I think it's hard to talk about in the abstract. It's hard to talk about if you've never had a lack of representation to explain why that is important. And also I wanted to show the kind of long-term effects of it, right? It's not just like, oh, I was really sad because I didn't have anyone to connect to or any fictional characters to connect to, or you know, it was a bummer, but it really affects what we think is possible for ourselves. You know, I think Yumi talks about just not even thinking that being an artist was a path because she didn't ever see any Asian American woman artists. And so, you know, being able to show that representation did play a part in people, what they thought was possible for themselves, what they ended up doing with their lives and the kind of work that they're creating now. And of course, you know, showing how far we have come, because the character did break a lot of stereotypes and was groundbreaking in a lot of ways, but obviously was also a product of her time and was not perfect, right? They, in the film, they talk about kind of how the character does play into some sort of tropes about, you know, Asian characters or just the way that we describe characters of color. And I think it's really cool to then look at the work that the interviewees are doing and see that, you know, they're really taking it to the next level, like you said, kind of really digging in even deeper into writing about their own experiences, right? Anna Martin is not a Japanese American teenage girl. and, you know, kind of talking about just approaching Asian American stories from a much wider lens and a much more personal lens.
Well, since COVID stepped in, I've been giving myself over to my inner middle school girl and trying to really watch a lot of the new YA stuff that's out there. And I started with maybe Pen 15 back in the spring. I've seen the British series Sex Education. I've been watching To All the Boys I've Loved Before. We've been looking at Mindy Kaling's Never Have I Ever. Across all of those, we're seeing a wide array of Asian, South Asian, East Asian characters surface as kind of almost a staple of the YA genre today. And I'm assuming to some degree they're a legacy of the Babysitters Club, but beyond that, just this generation of new creators that you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. I do feel like YA is a space in which we've seen such a huge explosion of, you know, authors and creators of color finally being able to tell their own stories. And it's been really cool to see that happen, you know, during my lifetime. These are things that I did not see on TV as a kid, you know? And so I definitely, I'm here for it. It's really cool to see. And I think the kind of, in some ways, the success of many of these stories does come directly from the fact that they are personal and that they are coming from more diverse writers' rooms and more diverse casts, that can really approach these things in a sensitive and personal way, you know? And I think that's also part of the Babysitters Club series on Netflix. You know, it is primarily women led, as, you know, directors, producers, writers, and also women of color. And I think that shows in the show.
I binged this after watching your doc. I binged the show with my family, and it was, I thought it was just great. It was really fun to watch with an 11-year-old girl who, you know, arguably like the title or the target audience, and to just sort of see, you know, just, it felt like a different kind of television. Definitely not the television from my youth that would have been more, you know, didactic and overbearing and like, you know, more pointed in raising an issue like a period or a whatever kind of coming of age thing that was going on. Because it feels like it does it in this kind of festive way. It has this wonderfully diverse cast and all these, you know, different kinds of issue of social issues and situations that just sort of felt like it normalizes things that each of them would have been mortifying to us. We would have felt like, oh my God, we're, you know, there's something wrong with us. And then there's like, no, there's something wrong, air quotes, with everybody. Like we all have, you know, like shit happens. And it just, it felt really in that way empowering and positive. And so I just, I was really impressed with how, you know, how they took that those original ideas of which were, I'm sure, a mixed bag and kind of brought them into the 21st century and where we are now in a way that feels much more like the TV we'd like to have.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I do think the books were enormously progressive for their time and their kind of spirit of inclusivity is a big part of why they're successful. I'd like to think, you know, like every single page passes the Bechdel test, you know, it's all about the girls' friendships and they are very independent and it does do a lot of work towards, like you said, like normalizing a lot of things that, you know, were seemed kind of more taboo at the time, like divorced parents or things like that, you know? And I think this, like you said, I think the series really does a lot to take those ideas and really bring them into the present day in a way that feels very organic and also has really strong storytelling, right? Because I do think there is this trend now of shows geared toward young people that still have that didactic kind of feel to it. Like, you know, I've definitely seen episodes of shows towards young people where like suddenly all the action stops and then there's like a little monologue about, you know, kind of Black Lives Matter or something. And it doesn't feel like it's connected to the storytelling or the character development. And this felt very organic to me and made a lot of sense in the way that they like, for example, I love that Dawn is now a Latina character and it's like, okay, she's from California. She's the activist. Like it totally makes sense that she would be a Latina, you know, and it's worked so organically into it. And I love her character, you know, as a new Californian, I really appreciate it. The California representation of, you know, the crystals and.
Totally. And another thing that I couldn't help but notice is the show about Manzanar, and so and bringing in the internment camps into this conversation in a way that you just don't ever see that, you know, handled. And of course, with your own work on Manzanar, like I was sensitized to it in a way. And so, I like, what was your reaction to that?
Yeah, that was amazing to see. I mean, I think it was really nice to see because, of course, Claudia's Japanese American heritage is part of her character in the books, but it's fairly surface level, I'd say. And it was really great to see the show bringing a lot more depth to that story. And I think it was also, you know, afterwards, I saw on all my social media, people were like, I've never seen this topic covered in a mainstream show. And, you know, kind of lots of people still don't know about that piece of American history, right? That thousands of Japanese Americans were just torn away from their homes and incarcerated during the war. And so that was really great to see. And yeah, it was kind of this, I didn't know that that was going to be part of Claudia's storyline. And it was a bit of a funny coincidence because I myself, like you said, I'm working on a an installation up at Manzanar National Historic Site that it's a sound installation that places, that geolocates snippets of oral history around the site and also allows people to record their own stories, right? So to kind of create this tapestry of memory and experience that you can encounter as you're at the site itself. So yeah, it was a funny coincidence, but love to see more coverage of it, you know, of this topic. And it's always great to see.
Yeah, I was aiming in the same direction, but I'm going to ask it in relation to the grandmother character and Claudia's relationship to the grandmother and the way that opens up cross-generational communication and family history and public history. I thought it's really beautifully integrated into the series in that regard.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think Claudia's grandmother was a huge character that a lot of people related to, even in the books. And that was a piece that I think a lot of specifically Asian American and also just other immigrant readers connected to, because that's, you know, the intergenerational family is just, you know, the families living together with their grandparents all in one household is something that I think was something that a lot of people experienced and had also not really seen depicted in mainstream media at the time. And Mimi was just this like great character, you know, always very supportive of Claudia and the other girls. And then so to see, you know, the character in the show and then to, for them to deepen the character and their relationship by talking about not only is Mimi this like great grandma, you know, that everyone loves, but it's also now bringing up issues, like you said, of kind of intergenerational trauma and, you know, the ability to, or the difficulty rather of kind of talking about some of these things, whether it's because of trauma or language barriers, you know, or all of these things. So I think it really touched on a big piece of the many people's immigrant experience.
And again, it did it in a way that at least to me felt like it was all the thing, you know, kind of like there were breadcrumbs to all those different things that you've just invoked, but it wasn't heavy handed or overbearing in a way that it was like, oh my God, this is the Manzanar episode and I'm going to cry myself to sleep and feel terrible. It was like, it was more like, if to me, it felt more like an invitation and a bit more understanding of this character that you've already come to love. And, you know, just like more humanizing in a way that I guess I responded to.
Yeah. And it made it part of her character journey, which I loved, right? It's like, well, what are you going to do with your art? Right. And
yeah.
It I love that they drew it back to kind of her growth as an artist, as well as just her perspective as, you know, a person. So.
Totally.
Well, it sounds like one of the things you're saying is that it's almost the scarcity of characters meant Claudia was a shared cultural capital for a generation of Asian American creative people. What will happen when we have this explosion of images and young adult stories, ever more particular? And, you know, this is the South, this is the Indian Hindu story, and this is an Indian Muslim story, and this is a Thai story. Does that break down that shared cultural capital, or is, do you think this generation will be able to make the kinds of creative connections that you described in relation to Claudia?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I think certainly we are getting to the place where more and more specific experiences are being depicted. Like I remember Gail saying, Gail, one of the interviewees, the graphic novelist for the most recent Babysitter's Club graphic novels, you know, came across this new Disney project, or is it Disney? It's like she came across a show where there's a half Thai, half white character. And she's like, I never thought I would see like this specific
like me,
experience.
Right?
Exactly. Right. Like I was just happy with like Mulan or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think, and I think that's great because I think the kind of conditions of scarcity when there is only one Asian American story or character actually sets up a lot of things to fail, right? Because then the expectations are just so high and it needs to speak to so many different people's experiences and it can't. Because the Asian American experience, quote unquote, is just so broad and so different across different cultures, different generations of immigration, different languages, different religions, you know. And so I think it's great that more stories are getting told. You know, I think that specificity actually, I think and I hope leads to greater possibilities for connection and solidarity, because I think we really connect to stories through that specificity, right? If you try to make like one Asian American movie that speaks to everyone, I don't think it's going to connect to anyone. But I think, you know, for example, like lots of people that are not Asian Americans really connected to Claudia. I had people saying, oh my God, like, you know, my grandmother also lived with the family, or, you know, I also had this really overbearing older sister or whatever. I think it's through the specificity that we're able to connect to the stories, and also, you know, less pitted against each other, right? If there's only one Asian American story and one Asian American character, the conditions are set up in a way that we are, you know, forced to compete for that one slot. And so I think the abundance of stories now is a good thing for sure. But also there's a lot more work to do still.
So walk us through the step, what's happening now that might lead to even greater representation or diversity. What's taking place out there?
Yeah, well, I mean, I do think things have gotten so much better since when I was a kid. You know, I could not have imagined the profusion of Asian American stories, or just, you know, of diverse stories in general compared to when I was growing up. I think there are a lot more creatives that have a platform. And then also with the success of stories like Black Panther or Crazy Rich Asians or any of these, you know, they're is, I think, slightly more awareness now that narratives about people of color have broad appeal.
Are awesome.
Yes, are awesome and can make money, and people can relate to them, even if they are not, you know, Black or Asian or whatever. So I think, you know, just like slowly the cultural bench, the conversation is shifting, and people's kind of baseline understanding of these things is changing. That said, I think in terms of access, you know, to funders, to money, to the powerful gatekeepers in the industry, I think it's still, you know, there's still a lot of obstacles in place. You know, everything in terms of who gets awards, to who gets grants, to who gets to helm big projects. So, for example, you know, Mulan just came out on Disney Plus. And I think a lot of people are rightly excited about it. It's a big event for Asian American representation, right? It's an all Asian cast in a huge studio movie. But at the same time, the director, the writers, the composer, the costume design, you know, many of the lead creatives are all white. And so I think when you're looking at not only the fact that these people got these jobs and these opportunities, but the fact that no one involved in the making of this movie at a high level thought that this was an issue. Right. You know, there's still definitely a lack of access, and then I think a lack of awareness or will on the side of the people who really have the power to change these things. So I think it's really exciting to see what's happening in the industry, and that there are more stories getting told and more people having access. But at the same time, I think there's still, especially when it comes to you know, everyone can tell their story and a low budget kind of you know, thing that they're just sending to their friends or whatever. But when it comes to who's actually getting the money and who actually has power to make big decisions, I think there's still a lot of work to be done.
And does the documentary world feel different from, you know, the nonfiction world versus the fiction world? I mean, the budgets are different and kind of process and timelines and, you know, talent and all that stuff. How's your experience there versus what you were just kind of glossing?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I definitely think the documentary industry is one in which historically women, people of color, other marginalized communities have had more access than in the rest of the film industry.
A little access.
Yeah, a little access.
As opposed to none. You know,
largely because I think there's less money involved. you know, and that's been really important for those communities. I also think that now that the documentary space is kind of exploding, now that we have a lot of big networks and streamers and things like that kind of suddenly or, you know, recently very interested in documentary, you know, we see some of those things filtering over in terms of who's getting big projects and who's getting, you know, awards and things like that. Now that there is more money in documentaries, you know, I think some of those problems are carrying over. Not to say that it was a perfect utopia of equality before, but yeah, I mean, I definitely think documentary has it feels to me like it has been a space in which people of color and women have had more access. And I've had the privilege through my career of working with a lot of, you know, primarily women of color teams, which I think has been, you know, a big part of how I got to where I am today, you know, having that mentorship and that support. But I think that work is happening. You know, it's very exciting to see, you know, the organizing that's happening within the industry with groups like Brown Girl Stock Mafia or the Asian American Documentary Network, where people are really supporting each other and with, you know, mentorship, with information, with connections that we wouldn't necessarily have access to in kind of the broader industry context.
Yeah, tell us more about that. That's an interesting story and doesn't get told often enough.
Yeah. So, I mean, they're both organizations. So Brown Girl Stock Mafia is, I think, about 4,000 Black, Indigenous, people of color, women-identified filmmakers, primarily in the documentary space. And the Asian American Documentary Network is Asian American filmmakers. And they're both organizations that were started by filmmakers who saw a need, who had had many experiences where they were the only filmmaker of color in a room full of white people, right? We're seeing all these opportunities where other filmmakers of color's names weren't brought up. We're having to explain issues over and over again to, you know, primarily white gatekeepers, funders, you know, other power players in the industry, and, you know, saw a need for filmmakers of color to really to organize, to help increase the access. So for example, Brown Girl Stock Mafia has sent a lot of groups of filmmakers to film festivals where they wouldn't necessarily have access because it costs a lot of money,
right.
Because they wouldn't necessarily be able to get industry credentials, you know, things like that. And then also provide a network of support once you're there, right? In terms of getting access to the right events or screenings or conversations with funders and people that might matter to your future projects. And both organizations, there's just a lot of kind of, I guess, like peer-to-peer crowdsourced knowledge sharing. So for example, on many of my projects, you know, certainly the Claudia Kishi Club, when I was looking, you know, it was a priority for me to have primarily women of color crew, since this is, you know, 100% a story about representation and access and that experience. And I, you know, I would just post on Brown Girl Stock Mafia, which is a Facebook group primarily, and, you know, be like, hey, does anyone know, have any recommendations for, you know, sound recordists in Los Angeles? And then get, you know, a listing of, you know, lots of people would share recommendations and things like that. And that's huge, because I think, you know, if you post in the normal industry forums of, you know, who's available, you know, you're not necessarily going to get that that sort of diversity or that sort of kind of vetted relationship. And same thing with, you know, just I think people post all the time about, hey, I'm having this problem. You know, I think I'm getting paid less than the white male director on this project. Have you guys been in this experience? Or have you guys had something like this happen to you? How did you handle it? Like, you know, what's okay for me to say? You know, like, I'm concerned. I don't want to be, you know, kind of blacklisted or kind of written off as someone who's difficult to work with, quote unquote. So, you know, everything from just super logistical stuff like, hey, my premiere keeps crashing. Does anyone know what to do? Or, you know, these much larger concerns about how to handle, you know, kind of situations where you feel marginalized or, you know, there's kind of a predatory relationship with the production company or anyone on the crew, things like that. It's huge to be able to have kind of a pool of not only experience, but, you know, support there.
That's amazing. I mean, it seems like a great response to sort of recognizing, you know, the existing networks and are exclusive and the barriers are uneven and saying, okay, well, let's create a network that, you know, that responds to that and responds to those kind of higher standards or kind of like the unfair standards in ways that are empowering and, you know, like reaffirming to our community. So that to me is pretty inspiring. So I mean, I know you always have like 50 different projects using all different parts of your, you know, your mind and your sets of talents and all of your whatever. What else, what are you working on now?
Yeah, well, so the I programmed the emerging media program for the Los Angeles Asian Pacific Film Festival. And so this year that's been delayed from its usual slot in May to start in late September and go throughout October. And of course that's, so that's what I'm working on. One of the things I'm working on now. And that's been really interesting, especially in the context of, you know, the pandemic, and the festival will be presented in an all virtual edition. So that's changed what the emerging media program looks like as well. You know, not a lot of people wanting to gather in places and put on virtual reality headsets that other people have worn. I think it's been a really exciting project to work on. A lot of these problems of access, representation that we've been talking about in the film industry are, you know, potentially even more heightened in kind of the emerging media space, where a lot of people are not coming from necessarily like a documentary background, where some of these issues have at least been discussed in mainstream venues. And there's, you know, there's some awareness that of the problems and things that need to be addressed. I think in virtual reality and emerging media generally, there's the same inequities, you know, lots of white men at the helms of virtual reality companies and projects. And there's been less discussion about some of the problems of representation, you know, the different, for example, the, you know, kind of colonial lens, or, you know, poverty porn, or just, you know, having equitable representation behind the camera, or the camera, if there is one. And so I think it was really important for me to, especially as this space is growing and becoming defined, right? We don't know what emerging media really is yet, in many ways, for people of color, for women to be represented in that conversation and to have a chance to help shape what these media become. Yeah, the program, you know, showcases Asian American creators who are working in virtual reality, augmented reality, you know, video games, installations, all kinds of things. And then this year, there's been, you know, less virtual reality because of the aforementioned limitations, and some really cool projects where people are working with the existing limitations. So we have like an interactive Zoom performance, which I'm really excited for. And then, you know, some live streaming stuff that's happening, basically all stuff that can be accessed through a web browser.
I mean, that seems a little bit like, just to pick up on that last piece, that seems a little bit like where we may be going, in the sense of, right, you know, I mean, I'd like to think the pandemic is going to be over soon, whatever that means, but it seems like that's unlikely. And then even when it is over, it's never going to be over. And so I wonder it's really important, as you're noting, to who's making the stuff, who's making the decisions, who the creators are, because you're beginning the next, you know, rev of this industry. And it's telling us something about where we might be going and what kind of storytelling, or what the affordances and limitations may be. It may not be possible that we're not gathering in public spaces and using a really expensive piece of equipment, or whatever, you know, the answer is.
Yeah, I mean, I also hope the pandemic will be over sooner rather than later. But I do think, you know, we are, it, you know, even just like working from home, right? Like things are not going to go back to exactly the way they were before, because of how complete the change has been during the pandemic, right? Like I think, unfortunately, there will still be Zoom meetings in the future. I think the limitations showcase maybe some of the strengths of other kinds of storytelling that we miss. Like there are physical installations that can't take place. And then that really reminds you that, oh, right. Like it is great to be able to experience a project in a specific space. And that is, I think reminds you of the strengths of things that you can't access or what you miss about things. Yeah. But it also, I think it's important that artists are kind of exploring, okay, what are the affordances of, you know, digital art or art that exists online? What kind of interaction can take place? And also, how can we make this better, right? Like, how can we explore this in a creative way thinking about what's possible, rather than a, okay, well, this sucks kind of way. Or both, right? A creative exploration of why this sucks.
So what for you are the affordances that are drawing you toward mixed reality, augmented reality, virtual reality right now? What's compelling to you as a media maker?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's always been interesting to me and certainly is front of mind now is the participatory nature of it, right? The ability for participants, you know, not viewers only, but participants to add their voices or to affect the course of the project, to have the project or to have a project be in some ways a collaboration between an author and then many other co-authors. And I think, you know, of course, it's been really crushing to see what's been happening with film festivals since the start of the pandemic. But one of the silver linings is many of these film festivals are able to reach much wider audiences than they would in their physical iterations. And I think that's the case with some of this kind of browser-based work that I'm looking at for the upcoming festival. You know, I've experienced amazing room scale virtual reality pieces, you know, at festivals in the past, at our festival in the past. But when you look at the number of people that can actually do that, right? Like we had a weekend installation at the festival, one of my favorite pieces, last year, we did a weekend of like the full emerging media program. And one of my favorite pieces was a 15-minute room scale piece. And if you look at, okay, Saturday, Sunday, you know, 8 hours each day divided by 15, like how many people saw that compared to something that is just broadcast online and people can access from their browsers, you know, the scale is quite different. Not to say one is necessarily better than the either, of course, but there is a scale that's possible with some of this browser-based work that wouldn't be possible with in-person experiences.
So, I mean, and also an inclusiveness, right? It means that folks who didn't have the money or couldn't travel there or, you know, wherever they are in the world, there's something about the numbers are vastly different, but it's also the diversity of humans who can have that experience. And that seems to me really important.
Exactly. So
I didn't mean to interrupt. Apologies. I just want to pile on with that little
bit. Absolutely. No, that's a huge piece of it because, you know, film festivals in general, virtual reality, a lot of this stuff, there is a high bar for access. Either in terms of, you know, physical proximity to places where you can see it, and then the monetary costs of either, you know, paying to go to a VR kind of facility or having a setup at home. Beyond that, I mean, in terms of the affordances that are exciting to me personally, I think I'm always really interested in work that's kind of pushing against very linear structured storytelling, right? That there is one version of a story and it proceeds in a very specific linear manner, right? Because that's not, of course, I love stories that are told that way, right? Classic films, you know, it's popular for a reason and successful for a reason. But that's also not how we experience our lives, right? As one series of events that happens kind of in a straight line, right? It's lots of experiences and our experience of time isn't linear all the time. So I think the ability for people to kind of really break that form in creative ways online is always really interesting to me. The ability to kind of have sort of a more collage based kaleidoscopic view of storytelling and time is really interesting to me, right? There's lots of cool interactive web projects where they've broken up a story into just lots of different pieces that you can experience in any number of ways.
So one of, you know, Colin's question got at something that I always struggle with in this, which is the way in which high tech and high art are being mapped onto each other in the space so that this becomes an elite cultural form. In a way that, say, video games have historically used interactivity, nonlinearity, in ways that were broadly, popularly accessible. So is that intrinsic to the world of VR and mixed reality right now? Is it doomed to be always an avant-garde form? Or is there a way that this can be used in a popular yet thoughtful way to challenge traditional storytelling where it lives with a mass audience?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a huge question. And I think the jury's out, you know, we're still waiting to see, because I think on the one hand, I mean, a lot of the work that appeals to me in this space is certainly falls into that avant-garde category, because many of the people that are working to really push the boundaries of these media are in that space, right? Who are thinking about what can we do with virtual reality or augmented reality? What's different about this form versus, I think, some of the more mass VR for me is just trying to recreate video games or films in a way that, you know, often leads you to think, okay, well, why don't I just play a video game or watch a movie instead? But I mean, I definitely think there's a lot of VR that's aiming for a mass audience, right? There's tons of, you know, the Void experiences, all the Star Wars VR, lots of kind of first-person shooter video game-esque VR. You know, certainly they're aiming for that audience. There's VR porn. You know, that was one of the first areas.
Always a leader. Yeah, any new technology.
Yes, but I think that stuff, first of all, has recreated many of the problems of access and representation that exist in those media. In terms of when we're talking about, like, the, you know, the mainstream large companies or the mainstream media that's being produced, right? You know, in action movies or in AAA video games. And also does not feel necessarily to me like it's exploring what the affordances of these platforms actually are. But I think part of, I don't know, I guess I would say the hope is that they can meet in the middle somehow, right? That some of these people working in a more avant-garde space or coming from a more artistic storytelling background can be in a position to influence more mainstream emerging media projects to be a little bit more thoughtful about why they exist in virtual reality or why they are in emerging media and what the affordances are, but then also for, you know, right, for it not to just be totally elitist and for there to be mass emerging media projects that are both widely accessible and accessible in terms of its content as well, while also being kind of creatively thoughtful.
I'm in. Sounds good.
Yeah, I'm viva the middle space. I mean, that's exactly what I'm wondering, is thoughtful use of the medium, intelligent use of genre tropes to open up a space for people to experience stories differently. I'm not sure that I'm totally excited any more than you are by things that are basically boys with their joysticks, you know, in a new space. Joysticks meant either metaphorical or actual. Either way, it doesn't really open up a lot for me. But as we're challenging representation and we're broadening the vocabulary of media, the popular seems like an important space to explore.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I am 100% on board. I can go on for hours about how The Fast and the Furious is one of the most important media texts of our time. So I am 100% on board. Yeah, and I think it's largely a matter of access and who's funding these projects, right? Where is the money for virtual reality? Who's funding these projects? Who's distributing it? Because I think that's one of the challenges for independent creators, certainly, is that there is a lot of money in the emerging media space, but it's not clear where it is necessarily. You know, with documentary, there's kind of a very known infrastructure of, like, these are the big funders, these are the big festivals, this is how it works. Not to say it's easy to navigate, but it is all there. Whereas I think in emerging media, it's much more kind of dispersed, you know, like who's funding these projects, how to distribute them, you know, where to distribute them, what the distribution model looks like financially. I think that's really, you know, constantly shifting and very hard to navigate. And I think it's a matter of, okay, well, if there's a more mass project, who can we bring on board to bring that kind of more thoughtful lens and, you know, kind of putting those people in conversation together.
I mean, it seems like because there aren't all the, there's not that existing infrastructure and all those processes and kind of like, this is how it works. That's a real opportunity, right? To say, let's not recreate the crappy systems that we have that are really limiting in all these different ways that we've mentioned. And it's also a challenge because I think the default is to those with money and those with power who are like, you know, they're white guys who have a certain narrow vision. And that incorporates less of the possibility, right? And the kinds of things that we're talking about. So it does feel like now is the time for interventions, you know, whether it's in sort of the things that people make that demonstrate the capacity for the media, or it's, you know, other versions or the Brown Girls Doc Mafia or whatever, where it's other kinds of entities that get in there early and are able to shift the conversation and the way that, you know, sort of space develops. Sue, in preparing for our interview, I was like, shit, the last time I heard you talk about Fast and Furious, I was all in. I took copious notes. I'm like, I gotta watch this. And then it was like yesterday, and I'm like, okay, which one do I start to watch? I can't binge 8 of them or 9 or however many there are.
Of course you can.
Well, not in like the 12 hours before. And so I started watching, you know, trailers, and I was like, okay, I'm getting a sense of the rhythm. And then I started to watch one, but of course I didn't finish. But like, bring me back to the Fast and Furious. Like, you're so compelling on this. Make your case for why it is the most important text of our time.
I just think, I mean, first of all, I'm a massive fan of the movies just as, you know, a consumer. I think they're very well done and fun to watch. I guess where to even start? I just think, you know, if you look at the top earning franchises of all times, Fast and the Furious is, I believe, the only one on there that's original IP, right? Like not Star Wars or Avengers or anything like that. Certainly one of the few, if there's another one on there. And, you know, yeah, one of the top earning franchises of all time. It's been going since 2001 at this point, has a massive global fan base. And I think, you know, why not take it seriously as a media text? You know, billions of people are watching this and receiving the messages. And I think on the level of if you trace it since the series beginning, if you look at, you know, its treatment of masculinity, its treatment of kind of race, right? Like, I think one of the biggest things about that always stands out for me about The Fast and the Furious is it really presents this very multiracial cast in a way that feels 100% organic. Mm-hmm. You know, Wesley Morris, in his review of the film, commented on the fact that at the time of that, sorry, now I'm going on a tangent, but he reviewed Fast Five and remarked that, you know, it's one of the only, or probably the only major Hollywood franchise where you could swap the races of pretty much any character and it wouldn't make a difference, right? The hacker guy is ludicrous, you know, the Asian guy is like the smooth talker kind of like sexy guy, you know, like it feels very organic. And then I think you can look at kind of the way they've shifted from, you know, these small time criminals that are being humanized and the police are the enemy, to now they're superhero agents of like the deep state, you know. So I think there's just a lot to unpack there. And I think the world building is actually very sophisticated. I think they are action movies that absolutely embrace what is great about action movies. And I really like them.
Yeah.
I'm in.
I'm fascinated by the career of The Rock, for example, who does such consistently interesting parts across films and has been so well used by that series. And that may be the exception as we go back to his island origins in one of the more recent Fast and the Furious films. He does take on a cultural specificity that's a little different from any character could replace the character or actor of a different race.
Yeah, and I think that's fascinating to look at too, right? The way that's shifted, because I would argue that for both Vin Diesel and The Rock, their ethnic and racial ambiguity was a big asset at the beginning of their career in Hollywood, where it was, you know, it was unclear or not as explicit, certainly. And I think that was an asset, right? Because they could be cast as, you know, quote unquote, anything. And I think now potentially we're in a place where the specificity is an asset, right? Where The Rock is like, no, I want to bring my Samoan ancestry into this and have it be a big part of the storyline of Hobbs and Shaw. And I think that's been interesting to see how that conversation has evolved too, for sure.
Well, this seems like it merits an entire episode because I want to learn from the masters and I want to be a little more prepared and at least get a bit deeper into the canon.
And really, if we're talking about Fast and the Furious, we should all have coronas, even if we're not together.
Yes, that sounds like a fun plan, and we'll have to make this happen.
That's a deal. I'm in. I'm absolutely in. So, okay, great. Is there anything you want to talk about regarding next, like what you're up to next or what your aspirations, hopes, dreams, passions, whatever?
Yes. So I'm not sure what's next. I mean, I do. So I have an art documentary that I directed for KCET that's premiering at the end of September on the California Light and Space Artists. So it was really amazing that we were able to finish filming right before everything locked down. You know, we went to Marfa, we went to Taos. We're looking at the work of Larry Bell, Robert Irwin, Helen Pashkin. So I'm excited for that to air. But yeah, I mean, mostly I'm excited to do something new, even though I don't know what that is, because everything I've been working on for the past couple of years has kind of been on the same schedule. I kind of started all my current projects at the same time, which was like fall of 2017, I guess. And I've been working on all of them since then. And I hope never to do that again, because it's terrible to be in the same stage in all your projects, right? Like, for example, right now I'm kind of in like wrap up stage on everything, where I'm just doing a lot of like paperwork and, you know,
interviews with boring people.
There's such a drag. But you know, I'm no longer kind of, in some ways it no longer feels actively creative, right? You're kind of just like doing technical deliverables and things like that. And of course, everything was supposed to premiere between March and May of this year, which meant that all of my projects were disrupted by, you know, the pandemic. And so that's a lesson learned, is to stagger things more in the future. But yeah, so everything's kind of in wrap-up stage, and I'm really excited to start some new projects and be in that exciting early phase of projects where you're kind of just throwing ideas at the wall, you know, and not and diving into the research I think that's like one of my favorite parts to be in on a project. So I'm excited for that.
Well, we'll definitely throw a bunch of links to your work in the liner notes. And I'm super excited. I mean, I'm so happy for the liberation that you're experiencing now of like having or about to experience after this podcast is done recording and after the paperwork is in, and to see you kind of the next, you know, rev of you unleashed on the world, and to see what you make. I no doubt it's going to be awesome and game changing. So
we'll
watch
you.
That with bated breath and get in on the Fast and Furious action that we discussed. I love that conversation with Sue. She just blows me away. She is so smart and thoughtful and knowledgeable about like all, as she said, she wants to be everything. And I'm like, and you did it, you know?
Absolutely. No, and the story she's telling us of this popular culture text, the Babysitter Club, having had this ripple effect across a generation of Asian American creative people. And now we're seeing the impact of that on the culture is a really incredible story.
And I have to say that I was also compelled by her observation of the Fast and Furious series as a really important text too. And so I'm like, you know, I'm probably three or four movies in, and I've been really enjoying it. And I love that range of, you know, sort of the recognition that something that may seem, you know, just entertaining can also be powerful in different ways, right? And you know, this is exactly where popular culture is so interesting, that it exists in this range from pure entertainment and escapism in the moment that I'm needing right now, through to things that are profoundly impactful and can actually change lives.
You know, and that mixture of commercial, creative, and political motives that shape popular culture make it such a perfect site for interventions, both those that are very conscious and those that are not. So as we were discussing the way Manzanar was represented in the Babysitter's Club, I found myself thinking about some of the recent work that George Takei has done. And Takei's always been a hero of mine, as Sulu from the classic Star Trek
to activists on Asian American issues and GLBT issues. But in the last few years, he's really been insisting on telling that story of the Japanese relocation camp through popular culture. So one way he did it was by his participation as a producer and a cast member of the show The Terror, which in its second season dealt with the camps in a really extensive way. I mean, it's a story set in the Japanese relocation camps and about a demon that follows the Japanese immigrants over from the old world to the new, and how that clashes with specifically American supernatural forces. So it's really I found the supernatural stuff, the horror stuff, was not the best, but the representation of the camps were really quite remarkable. And then last year, he released a graphic novel called They Call Us Enemy, which may not be March, the John Lewis graphic novel, which so much has been said about. It's not quite on that level. But again, it tells his own personal story as a young man who was in the camps, and his family's story and journey to the camps, their experience in the camps, and what happened to them afterwards through the graphic novel form. And I think that will also help open up a new generation of young people to what happened during this period of time, which when I was growing up, no one was even willing to speak about or acknowledge the existence of. And now popular culture is saying we got to address this because it shaped so profoundly the Asian American experience in America today.
So as you're talking, you being a true scholar of this and me being more of a fan, and I guess I'm kind of struck at all the different, you know, we're aware of so many problems in the world. And there has long been a lament on that we've had around representation and who's making media, right? And we've talked a lot about the power in the past of the power of critics of color. With Sue, we talked about how some of the hacks were like getting people into film festivals and, you know, sort of changing the way that these structures have accreted to be insular and to kind of protect against new kinds of stories and new storytellers. And so, you know, it feels like it's been like that for a long time, but all of a sudden, and you know, look at our colleague Stacey Smith's research at USC, and just like documenting who's in movies, who makes movies, and it's terrible, and music too, right? And now the way we're talking about it, it feels like we're in a monumental shift, like a tectonic shift that has happened incredibly quickly, where there are indeed new voices and new makers and new stories being told. And not to say that in any way it's done, but like we're seeing change actually happen. Whereas if you think about in politics or in so many other walks of life, the change feels like it's more glacial. And that seems like that's another feature of popular culture, that it is more responsive, both in terms of anticipating perhaps some amounts of where things are going, where the zeitgeist is, and then when it happens, reacting to it quickly.
Well, I struggle with this in terms of Stacey's work sort of depicts a glacial slow change. And yet we're observing, when I look at the texts that are generating the discussion that people are engaging with, I see a much more rapid change.
Mm.
So to some degree, we're still focusing on the exceptional text, and she's documenting the norms of the industry.
Right,
and
right.
So yes, on an exceptional level, there are works that are stimulating people, that are getting people excited. And we saw in this episode that even a singular phenomenon like the Babysitter's Club could have a ripple effect on the culture and how people saw themselves. So the moment where we're seeing all of these new shows on television or films, they pop against the backdrop of the mundane, the everyday, the typical, which is still heavily segregated. So it raises this question of how do we make the best intervention? And this goes to something underlying the latter half of that discussion there about pop culture and the avant-garde, right? Is it, you know, the avant-garde yeah. maximizes freedom to bring new stories and new experiences to bear, but at the cost of alienating large chunks of the audience that are never going to see that work, either because of the distribution systems or just because aesthetically it doesn't speak to them. The dominant media reproduces the same old formulas and doesn't allow us much space for new voices, new perspectives. It's that middle space that Sue was talking about, where the avant-garde, the new, meets the old, is where change is taking place. And one would never call the Babysitter Club an avant-garde text. I'm not sure I'd even say it's fully in the middle, but that's, you know, the sense some of these other shows that we're talking about that are pushing the boundaries of what television has done in the past are maybe middle ground text, whether it's the stuff I was just talking about with George Takei, or whether it's something like Lovecraft Culture Country, which is really using horror as an avant-garde form to push how we tell the story of blackness and mid-century America and pushing in some really extraordinary directions. That space where genre meets the new is a space that I find particularly promising in popular culture.
Wow. As ever, Henry, you dropped the nuggets. Thanks so much for that.
Well, always enjoy bouncing ideas back and forth. So,
just a quick but heartfelt word of thanks to our amazing production team who makes this all happen. Josh Chang, Karin Navatia, and Sophie Maggi.
Thanks to the continuing support for both the Civic Imagination Project and the Civic Media Fellows here at USC by the MacArthur Foundation.
Huge thanks to our awesome colleagues at the University of Southern California who give us lots of ideas, moral support, and sometimes even listen to the show.
You never write. Write us at hdylist_podcast on Instagram and Twitter. We are now Insta-worthy.